Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is They're Not Immigrants, They're Refugees, a critical look at migration, immigration, jobs, national security, and the welfare state. We are very honored to have with us today Professor Don Boudreau. Welcome, Don.
Good to be here.
Good. Folks, Don is a professor of economics at George Mason University, a former president of the Foundation for Economic Education, and the author of the excellent book, Globalization, and one of the foremost scholars in the world today on the philosophy of freedom and liberty. Don, before we talk about immigration, let's talk about migration and travel for a minute. For most of history, most people traveled without the approval of the state, without a passport. The risk of travel was on the traveler and not the state. When did that start to change?
My understanding is that it changed about 100 years ago, right around the World War I era. I'm not exactly sure, but I know that Russia and Turkey were two of the first countries to actually demand passports of people entering their societies, their countries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those two countries back then were not exactly the freest on earth. Free mm-hmm. countries in Western Europe, North America, even South America, didn't have any such restrictions as we have today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so it started about 100 years ago, and prior to that time, people just went where they wanted to go, and were they basically harassed by local authorities if they were foreigners?
I'm speaking mostly of America, mm-hmm. not that I'm aware of. You know, mm-hmm. every society has a certain fear of foreigners, and that's why you had places like Chinatown and my hometown, New Orleans, the Irish Channel. Had these enclaves of immigrants, and so people wanted to, you know, sort of stay to themselves. But after the first generation or two, they merged into the larger culture, which is why we have this wonderful, vibrant, diverse culture in America today.
So, prior to the whole passport visa kind of transformation in world travel, how did they keep out troublemakers, or did they?
Well, in the United States, you know, the system that we had basically until 1924, mid-1920s, was we had checkpoints, Ellis Island being the most important one, most famous one, and people would come through. There were no numerical limits on the number of people who could come. There were no racial or ethnic or religious or country origin restrictions. People came. The authorities at these checkpoints checked to make sure these people didn't have any serious communicable diseases and to make sure that they weren't known violent criminals. Mm-hmm. If people weren't these two, if they didn't have those two things against them, they were allowed in. End of story.
So, of course, you know, there were always there have always been those that wanted to pull up the ladder of opportunity to prevent others from getting aboard. Some of the early founders of America wanted more open immigration, others wanted less. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, immigration is mentioned explicitly in the Declaration of Independence. One of the explicit complaints lodged by Thomas Jefferson and his colleagues in 1776 against King George III was that King George would put too many restrictions on the number of people allowed to immigrate into then British North America. And the founders of our country saw that restriction rightly as indeed not only restricting the freedoms of the people who wanted to immigrate into America, but restricting the economic opportunities of Americans themselves, because the fewer workers you have here, the less opportunity there is here to prosper and thrive.
Mm-hmm. We're going to, when we come back from our break, expand on this concept of migration, because we Americans are pretty used to the idea of going wherever we want to go. But we're going to take a brief break, folks. So please stay with us. This is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. I'm talking with Professor Don Boudreau. We'll be back in just a minute, so please stay with us. Talk to you soon. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay. And with me today is Dr. Don Boudreau, and we're talking about immigration, and specifically, the topic that we have today is they're not immigrants, they're refugees. But before the break, we were talking about this topic of migration, and I'd like to expand this for just a minute with you, Don, because Americans are used to the idea of freely moving and traveling throughout the USA as they wish, yet Judge Napolitano has warned that there are new laws coming that will make it harder for all Americans to move about, find work, and associate with other people peacefully. And otherwise, these laws will ensnare us. And, of course, you know what I'm talking about. Would you please comment on that?
Well, I'm afraid the judge is absolutely correct. Two things. Obviously, in America, we move all the time, not only as tourists, you know, travel from Virginia to California, but we move residences all the time. I was born and raised in Louisiana. Now I live in Virginia, where I've lived for most of my adult life. I'm an immigrant from Louisiana to Virginia. No one thinks twice about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm better off, obviously, but so too, I would hope, and I think in general, so too is the economy. I'm able to move to a place where I can put my talents to their best use, and which is at George Mason as opposed to a school in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think twice about it. But somehow when you put up a national border, people start thinking very differently about it, and I can't figure out why, really. There's no economic case for thinking
mm-hmm.
differently about migration across national borders as opposed to internal migration. Now, unfortunately, given that most people do think that there is a big difference, and most people are fearful, or many people are fearful of immigration for a variety of reasons, politicians respond to this fear, obviously, we're now moving toward a system where, and Democrats, you know, the supposedly great champions of civil liberties, at least Democrats, are right up there at the top proposing legislation that would basically require all Americans to carry a national identification card.
Can I interrupt you for a second and ask you, is the idea that all workers are going to have to carry national ID cards?
Well, yes, under some proposal. No such proposal has passed yet, but yes, because you're going to have to show that you have to prove that basically prove that you can be lawfully employed, right? which is absurd. Because
right.
in a free country, why should we need the government's approval for you to hire me or me to hire you or for me to hire some guy to cut my grass or to cut my hair or to build my house? That's not consistent with a free society. And what people forget when they get – the people who are very enthusiastic about this national ID, they imagine that it doesn't apply to them. Or they imagine they have nothing to fear from it. Oh, sure, I'll carry my ID because I'm a good, solid American. I have nothing to worry about. Right? Well, but just imagine applying for a job and having to pull out your papers to prove to your employer that you can be hired. We have to do in a way similar things now. Since 1986, the government has really gotten into the business of trying to verify employment. But obviously, there are a lot of loopholes. Illegal immigrants have no trouble finding cash employment, so the attempts to crack down on that will mean that there will be much more stringent attempts to control employment throughout the economy, and those attempts will inevitably affect American citizens and people with green cards and immigrants who have Uncle Sam's permission to work.
Yeah. I actually was a little disingenuous in the way I asked that question because I'm aware that this proposal is actually a joint proposal between Mr. Schumer out of New York, who's a Democrat, and Mr. Graham, who's a Republican out of South Carolina. And this particular idea they have has an acronym called the BELIEVE system, which, of course, always stands for the opposite of what you want it to believe or want it to mean, or it's completely nonsensical. In this case, that word, believe system, means biometric enrollment, locally stored information, and electronic verification of employment. Now, one of our contributors at Radio Free Market has been a young Harvard student, Mr. Christopher Opperman, who recently wrote a piece for the Harvard Salient where he said, steer clear of any proposal that enjoys enthusiastic bipartisan support, such as the Schumer-Graham proposal.
I couldn't agree more. The candidates are legion, but Chuck Schumer and Lindsey Graham himself, they are two of the most unprincipled human beings in Washington.
I have noticed that, actually. So let's talk a little bit about that proposal. Yeah. Let's talk about what that particular proposal would do, because I'd like to I initially wrote four jobs, but I think we should phrase it two jobs. There's a couple of things, as you mentioned, employers registering all employees with the federal government by either a federal-approved scanning machine or registering a person at a local office with heavy fines if they do not. I mean, that's pretty crazy. I mean, please comment on the cultural costs that you see of living under a regime where we have to respond to your papers, please.
It's an interesting question because, one of the arguments given against immigration is a cultural argument. People will say, and a lot of people, on the right especially, say, immigrants, I'm all in favor of openness, but, these people come from a very different culture, and if they get here, their culture is less entrepreneurial than ours, and maybe that'll drag down the entrepreneurial spirit in America. And I always respond by saying, look, in order to enforce the immigration restrictions that you want, we have to sacrifice the very American principles that you claim, you immigration opponent, you claim that you're championing. Right? To have a papers please requirement in America is the antithesis of the American spirit, antithesis of classic American liberty. I'm absolutely sure that James Madison and Jefferson, even Alexander Hamilton, would be totally flabbergasted and angry to learn such a thing. So we're willing internally to completely upend our culture, to endorse and embrace restrictive policies that go against our history, that are in violation with the greatest streams of thought and culture in our history. We're willing to do that in order to keep a few foreigners out of the country, people who want to come here to work. That seems backwards to me.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
I agree with you 100%. I can actually foresee kind of a replay of the 60s when my generation were burning draft cards, and we might see a whole host of Americans burning their national ID cards.
Yeah, well, I'll burn mine.
Yeah, it very well could happen. So let's switch gears here for a minute and talk about the other side, this warfare state, of the warfare state, which is really what this national ID concept is an extension of. And let's talk about the welfare state a little bit. You've written, and I'm going to read this quote from you, "I have long been a proponent of opening America's borders much more widely, say the way they were in the 1920s. Such borders would not be totally open. Rather, immigrants would come in the same way they did for most of America's history, those who were not carriers of communicable diseases or those who weren't known violent criminals were allowed in. They were unimpeded, save for the relatively brief inspection at ports of entry, such as Ellis Island." So, rather than calling you an open border advocate, I would refer to you as a checkpoint advocate, but very open at the same time. What are the upsides that you would see to this kind of thing?
The
structure that you propose?
Many. First of all, America would become wealthier. Right? We have more creative minds, more workers, and economically what happens when you have more workers coming in is you have a deepening of the division of labor. People are able to specialize in tasks that for which there was no market earlier. but for which their talents are better suited. Mm-hmm. Adam Smith taught at the very beginning of his great book, The Wealth of Nations, that a nation becomes wealthier the greater is the division of labor, specialization. Mm-hmm. The greater the number of workers we have in the economy, the greater the amount of specialization, the wealthier we become. So right off the bat, there is an economic case for immigration. Mm-hmm. And by the way, even the most celebrated academic critic of immigration, an economist at Harvard, George Borjas, even he, who was very critical of immigration, although he himself is from Cuba, mm-hmm. Borjas concedes that immigration, this is a lowball estimate, immigration it makes a net contribution to the American economy.
And actually, I have his quote in front of me here. It says, although the entry of immigrants reduces the wages of comparable natives, it increases slightly the income of U.S. natives overall.
That's right. That's right. And the only comparable comparable natives that he's talking about are high school dropouts.
Mm-hmm.
And the maximum effect he gets is an 8% fall in the annual income or wages of high school dropouts. So this is hardly a terrible economic effect, even for the people who are hurt most. But overall, it's a net, immigration is definitely a net benefit. Another benefit is, of course, a freedom benefit. I view immigration restrictions ultimately as my government, the government claims to represent me, restricting my freedom of association. The government pre-screens for me the people that I can with whom I can associate.
Don, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we have to take a break right now. Folks, stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Free Market. Come back to us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Professor Don Boudreau, and we're talking about immigration. And Don, just before the break, we were talking about the net benefits of a kind of a checkpoint system, which is much more open, not quite a pure open border concept, but a concept that would only restrict those that were known violent criminals and those that had communicable diseases. So you were outlining some of the other benefits of this kind of structure to us. Please continue.
Well, greater freedom, and not only for foreigners who would like to live and work in America, but greater freedom for Americans. As I was saying, immigration restrictions imposed by Uncle Sam serve as a screening device on the people whom I might wish to associate with on my private property.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm capable of choosing who I want to mow my lawn, who I want to cook my meals in a restaurant, who I want to marry, who I want to invite into my house for a glass of wine or a cup of coffee. That's my business. But the government, by pre-screening, says, no, we get first say. We keep a lot of people out, and only those who get in without permission, only then can you choose to invite them to be your coworkers or your employees or your employer or your spouse. And that's a restriction on my freedom. And freedom of association surely counts, or ought to count, as a fundamental human freedom, a right that ought not be violated by the state, and immigration restrictions violate that right.
Well, you know, it's obvious to me that this kind of a structure would save billions upon billions of dollars and allow resources to be redirected toward protecting citizens from real harm.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have, I don't know how many billions of dollars spent annually think about this. I mean, this is really perverse. We're spending billions of dollars annually trying to prevent people who are willing to work and want to work from coming to America to work. Now, that is perverse beyond imagination. And yet we do it, and most people don't blink an eye at it because we've done it so long. There are, obviously, in the world, a handful of people, some internally, many externally, who would like to inflict violence on innocent Americans. And let's devote, let's take all the resources that we're now wasting trying to protect us from people who want to work here, let's take those resources and instead redirect them to focus on discovering would-be terrorists and punishing would-be terrorists.
Would this obviously kind of a structure make it easier to apprehend would-be terrorists?
I think it would. You know, people have this mythical this delusion that if only we really got strict on the borders, only if we really enforced the immigration laws as they now exist, then only approved people could get in. But that's absurd. We have huge borders, unfenced borders in Canada and along the Mexican border. We have, obviously, seacoasts, a lot of seacoasts.
Mm-hmm.
Any terrorist who wants to get in to inflict harm can get in.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll get in under any regime. And so I think the best we can do is to, first of all, open up immigration. That'll make the economy even wealthier. That'll increase the amount of resources we have to devote to thwarting and apprehending terrorists. So I think it would get better in the sense that the immigration enforcement effort, right, or the Protect American effort would not be diluted. It would be focused on protecting us from real harm rather than spread out and protecting us from people who want to work, which is where the bulk of the resources are spent, which is absurd.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is the most common objection to more open immigration that we have our welfare state, and there's a number of problems with this argument, and I want to kind of go through them fairly systematically with you. One of the more problematic is this endorsement or basically this problem that's been thrown up by Milton Friedman himself, who otherwise was a great advocate for free trade, but he argued against more open borders because of the welfare state. But you've disagreed with his thinking. Can you outline that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a great fan of Milton Friedman. He was truly a wonderful economist and a great champion of freedom. But I'm quite confident that on this issue he was wrong. He just did not think about it with the same rigor that he normally thinks about things. And here's the first reason I say that. If the main problem with immigration is that immigrants are coming here to milk American taxpayers, then why is so much immigration legislation devoted to preventing immigrants from working? It's crazy. You know, if someone from Mexico wants to come to America to suck off the welfare state, then, well, first of all, let me back up. I'm opposed to the welfare state, just as Milton Friedman was. I get rid of the welfare state. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But let's take it as a given for now. The welfare state exists. Then at least before you conclude economically about the effects of immigration and the welfare state on immigration, at least before you do that, you have to say, all right, let's open up the opportunities to immigrants to work.
Okay, I'm going to have to interrupt you again. This is Radio Free Market. We're going to take another break, so please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market. I'm your host, Michael McKay, and Professor Don Boudreau. We were just talking about this famous comment by Milton Friedman that he thought that because of the welfare state, more open immigration was not possible, and you were commenting on that. Would you please expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, my main point is that Friedman was at least he was very weak in thinking this through, because most immigration restrictions take the form of preventing immigrants from working, or trying to prevent immigrants from working, which, by the way, also puts a dampening effect on some American citizens and some foreigners with green cards from working. Because if documentation isn't there, if someone lost their green card, for example, or if an employer is worried that, you know, a man named Gonzalez who was, you know, from Arizona, but, you know, maybe looks like he may be from Mexico, to the extent that employers are worried about being penalized for unknowingly hiring illegal immigrants, then that puts a dampening effect even on the employment prospects for some Americans. So that's another way in which immigration restrictions affect opportunity and freedom of Americans themselves. But look, the welfare state needs, again, we're assuming the welfare state's a given, right, here for this conversation. The welfare state needs resources. And where do you get resources? You get resources from workers. Right? So even if there is a number of immigrants are coming to America in order just to suck off the welfare state, right, then they at least have to be offset against those immigrants who come here to work. And it very well could be, in fact, the evidence the evidence is pretty strong that it is the case, that the immigrants who come here to work, by adding a net amount to the economic pie and adding to tax revenues, actually pay for whatever additional burdens on the welfare state might be created by immigration.
So, you know, one of the things about this welfare argument is that it's actually not the real concern. The real concern is jobs. People are concerned that their jobs are going to be taken over and that the immigrants are going to compete and maybe take away the jobs from native-born Americans. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, in a free economy, or an economy that's even reasonably free, like ours, at least last time I looked, maybe, you know, it's changed within the last 10 minutes, but even in a reasonably free economy, jobs are created for people who want them. Entrepreneurs find opportunities to produce things, and they hire workers. You know, in 1950, the civilian labor force in the United States was about 60 million people. Today, it's about 145 million people. And so the number of people in the labor force has much more than doubled just in the past 60 years. And the number of jobs has more than doubled in the past 60 years. And, you know, by the way, it's not just immigrants who are entering to America to get jobs. Think about all the women in the post-World War II era who've entered the workforce. Mm-hmm. There wasn't, as far as I remember, any great outcry about, well, you know, women entering the workforce are going to take jobs away from men. It didn't happen. What happens when more people enter the workforce is that, as I said earlier, the division of labor deepens, specialization changes, the way we work changes, and that makes us all wealthier. And so when immigrants come to America, they make us wealthier because they expand the workforce, which increases specialization, which is the ultimate source of wealth for a nation, as Adam Smith explained. And so again, even if some handful of immigrants are themselves a net drain on the welfare state, that drain must be counted against the larger additions to the tax base and, more importantly, to the economy by the larger number of immigrants who come here to work and who work honestly and work hard.
Okay. Now, you had written that a lot of the real problem is the prohibitions on immigrants finding legal employment. And, you know, one of the biggest complaints that you hear repeated over and over again in common coffee shop conversation is that immigrants overuse hospital emergency rooms. Is this related to them being paid in cash?
Yes, of course. I mean, whenever I hear that complaint, I go, duh. Yeah, you know, first of all, illegal immigrants are not allowed to work at all, obviously, lawfully. Even many legal immigrants have severe restrictions on where they can work and for whom they can work and how much they can be paid, right? And so here we have a class of people who are discriminated against unfairly in their employment opportunities. Well, is it any wonder then that, so that first of all, that many of them cannot afford the kind of health care that they would be able to afford were they able to work legally. Mm-hmm. Secondly, most of us get our health care through employer, tax-exempt tax-deductible employer-provided health premium payments.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're illegal and you're being paid in cash, then your employer is not going to sign you up for such a health insurance program because it'll expose that employer to being prosecuted and fined mm-hmm. by the government.
Sure.
So therefore, these cash employees, they have no health insurance. They have no health insurance not because they don't want health insurance. They have no health insurance because to get affordable health insurance would expose them as being, quote, unquote, illegal. Therefore, when they become ill, it's not surprising at all that they go to the emergency room because emergency rooms are required by statute not to turn away anyone who comes to them. Mm-hmm. And they don't ask any questions. And so when if you go to an emergency room, you don't need to show an insurance card. You get treated. So it's not surprising that it is a fact that immigrants tend to use hospital emergency rooms in numbers disproportionate to their size of the population. But that's an artifact of the immigration restrictions. There's nothing natural about Mexicans who, or Hispanic people who like to go to emergency rooms. It happens because of the restrictions.
You know, I want to reiterate some of the points that you made earlier and then make ask you to comment if you want to deepen on any of these things, because you made some really fantastic points I want the listeners to listen to and listen to again. And the first one is that that employers should be able to hire whomever they want at whatever wage that can be agreed to. And it's not the government's business who I hire or how much I pay, and that in spite of the restrictions the government imposes on immigrants to work, that they still work, they pay taxes, actually maybe even pay more taxes, they expand the economic pie, as you call it, for all of us. And so would you care to comment on the, on those points a little bit further?
Well, it's basic economics. And let me put it in historical perspective. In 1776, when the United States declared its independence formally from Great Britain, the population was about 3 million people. Now, at the time, colonial North America was one of the richest places on Earth, still not as rich as London, but it was reasonably rich. We are vastly more wealthy today than colonial America. If the basic underlying economic theory, quote-unquote, about immigration is correct, then Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and George Washington, they should have been much wealthier than we are. We are much wealthier. We're much wealthier because now we have millions of people in our economy who are working and creating and contributing to it. Also, think about just today across the country. Manhattan is very, very wealthy and also very, very highly populated. Mississippi's not as wealthy. Right? Now, there's nothing wrong with Mississippi. Some people like to live in more rural, bucolic areas. Other people like mm-hmm. to live in very large cities. But the idea that more people in some jurisdiction reduces wages and reduces the standard of living just does not conform to historical fact. Just look. What's a richer city, Jackson, Mississippi, or New York? New York
right,
is
exactly.
a wealthier city.
Let's talk for a second about how restricting immigrants from working creates dangerous black markets. And, government makes the legal market actually more cumbersome by imposing these costs that that affect employers to the tune of literally thousands of dollars per employee. Would mm-hmm. you please comment on that?
Just in my own neighborhood here in Virginia, we had a case a couple of years ago that was a very sad case. It was a direct result of these restrictions. Day laborers, of course, these people who hang out in parking lots of convenience stores waiting for people to hire them, they know that happens because of restrictions on immigration. And so a couple of years ago, one of these day laborers, a guy from Mexico, he got into a dispute with some guy who hired him to help remodel his home. And unfortunately, the homeowner, the Mexican, killed him. He murdered him.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, this person should be punished. But the with a more open market for labor, these construction workers would be less likely to be hired just off the street. They would be hired by home remodeling firms, for example, and those firms have incentives to screen for, you know, good workers and screen out crazy or potentially violent workers. And so that's one instance where, you know, by forcing people into the shadows, as I think you called it, it harms not only the workers who are forced into the shadows, but it makes the ability of law-abiding Americans to it makes it more risky for law-abiding Americans to hire these people because there's no effective way to screen out the reliable workers from the less reliable workers. They all get lumped into one pool. So
that's right. Well, it's also very interesting that these additional costs that are imposed by the government. Most folks don't know that the Department of Labor increased the minimum wage for foreign farm workers to $12.24. And, you know, that means that employers are incentivized not to hire them. But there's other perverse effects, such as the highly skilled foreign people that have specialty occupations. The Immigration Service typically targets them, which it's kind of a contrary kind of situation where the talk is all about these unskilled laborers, but the immigration effects is being focused really significantly on the skilled laborers.
I'll give you a good example. For 8 years until last year, I was chairman of the Economics Department at George Mason, and every beginning of every semester, every September and every January, I would have visitors come to my office, and they were always Indians, young Indian men, sometimes Indian women, and they were here on student visas to study engineering at George Mason, and their visas allowed them to work only on campus. They could work on campus, but they could not work off campus. And, of course, there are only a limited number of jobs on campus, and so these engineering students would come to the economics department and basically beg for employment. Say, I can do anything for you. I said, well, you know, I don't have a job for you. I never had the budget to hire them. And so here you have talented, entrepreneurial, smart, energetic people begging for jobs that they can't get, prohibited from going off campus and working for a non-collegiate private employer. Now, not only does that hurt those students, it hurts Americans in general because the output that we would have gotten from their extra employment, the profits that the American employers would have received from being able to hire them, all that is never created. And that's just another – most people don't know about that pernicious effect of immigration restrictions on even those immigrants who are here with the permission of Uncle Sam.
Right. Well, you know, people don't recognize the tremendous benefit that immigrants, not just your grandparents, my grandparents, had made to our economy, but in current day. I mean, the founder of Google is an immigrant.
That's right. The founder of Intel is an immigrant. I mean, in some sense, obviously, we're all immigrants. Mm-hmm. Just some of us, you know, we came here a few generations earlier. It's trite to say, and because it's so trite, people say it so often, it's kind of losing it's losing its meaning, unfortunately. It's certainly losing its emotional impact. But we are a nation of immigrants. And, and you know, the period of greatest immigration as a proportion of the population and the economy was in the late 19th century, you know, from about the 1880s through the first decade of the 20th century. That was a period of enormous economic growth. There was a downturn in the 1890s. It had nothing to do with immigration. It had to do with bad monetary policy. But that was a period of great economic growth, transcontinental expansion, creation of goods that today we take for granted, the telephone, refrigerated railroad cars that enable beef to be slaughtered centrally and shipped across the country and hence lowered the price of food. The guy who invented that is Gustavus Swift, who I believe himself was an immigrant from Germany. The contributions made to the American economy by literal immigrants, by people who were born abroad and came here, is enormous. And when we prevent immigration, we never see the opportunities that Americans are denied because they are not created, because those people who would have created those opportunities for Americans are denied admission. And that's a real shame.
That's an excellent point. So true immigration would make legal channels more appealing and not less. And in that context, let's talk about Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that most folks know that Arizona has passed a very strong anti-immigration law. And without belaboring it, I would like to go over a couple of the points about it with you that make this particular law a particular problem model, if you will. Let's start with that people are guilty until proven innocent.
Obviously this is not the American way, as people say. It gives police enormous leeway, police in Arizona enormous leeway to detain people just on suspicion that they might not be here with the government's permission. Now, the defenders of that Arizona statute will say, oh, no, the people who might be detained in that way have to first be apprehended for committing some other kind of crime. And that's true. But as Judge Napolitano, you mentioned him earlier, points out, and he's a judge, he's seen how law enforcement officers actually work. And he's very concerned that he seems to be certain that the way this statute is written, that it would be very easy for law enforcement authorities who...
Okay, we're going to have to break right now, Don. We'll be right back, folks, for our last segment. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me, Dr. Don Boudreau, and we're talking about immigration. And Don, we were just talking about the Arizona problem, and one of the first things is that it comes across with this notion that people are guilty until proven innocent, and that there can be random requirements for ID upon reasonable suspicion. And this has the support of conservatives there in Arizona. Please talk about some of the other problems with it.
Well, I mean, the problems themselves are like all these problems, they're created by the immigration restrictions themselves. If we had legal entry points of the sort that I advocate, like Ellis Island, then that's where immigrants would come through. They wouldn't have to sneak in. The very fact that they're sneaking in, the very fact that they are, unfortunately, coming in across people's private property is because points of legal open entry are denied to them.
But property crime is down in Arizona 20% in the last 10 years, and violent crime down 19%.
That's right. A lot of the increase in crime are things like reported trespassing. You have some guy from Mexico just crossing someone's property in order to get into America. It's trespassing. It's a crime, but it's not violent crime. It's not the kind of crime that people really worry about.
Right. Now, some Arizona cities are actually suing over this law, Flagstaff and Tucson, I understand.
I didn't know that. I was unaware of that. But
they're actually suing the state of Arizona for the enforcement costs and the negative effects on the state's tourism industry. And the Flagstaff City Council voted unanimously to sue the state. So there is a groundswell of opposition right from there. And, from a political point of view, it makes sense for Republicans to support legal migration, doesn't it?
Yeah, and, not all conservatives take that position. The Wall Street Journal editorial board has been very, very good over the years in supporting much more open immigration for all the right reasons. So it's really unclear to me why there are so many conservatives who are on this anti-immigration bandwagon.
Well, let's not try to solve that problem right now. Let's talk about the El Paso miracle, because that's really the big story that most people are not aware of.
It's a booming border town. Same country, obviously, the Arizona borders, mm-hmm. Mexico. It's a very safe town.
One of the safest cities in the United States, safer than Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah. And but we don't hear about this the, because safe is not sensational. You know,
right.
TV cameras, you know, filming safe doesn't make news. You film.
It has 27% poverty rate. 25% are foreign born. They have laxer gun laws. It should be a bloodbath, but it's not.
It's not. Yeah. It's quite the opposite. It's quite the
opposite. Yeah, they had 27 murders in last year as opposed to 234 in Baltimore, and Baltimore is a smaller city.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, which says a lot. And so that's booming. San Diego is another great example. And also keep in mind, as it should be pointed out, a lot of the crime that does exist all along the border is a result of America's unjustified, quote, war on drugs. And
yeah, I'm going to quote John Cook, the mayor of El Paso, who said, most people in Washington really don't understand life on the border. They don't understand our philosophy here is that the border joins us together. It doesn't separate us. Well, Don, I'm going to have to wrap this up with a poem from Emma Lazarus, the famous poem about the Statue of Liberty, which goes, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Let us say amen to that. So my thanks to you, Professor Don Boudreau, for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
And I hope you will be with us again. And folks, please visit Don at cafehayek.com. And this is Michael McKay in Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.